Thank you, Julian. And thank you, everybody, for turning out in 8th week on a horrible cold evening. It's very good of you. I'm sorry we haven't got our phalanx of celebrities as Vice-Chancellor sitting in the front, but still, we will manage. Now, I've found a lot of the useful stuff in the discussions, so I'm intending, if I can time it properly, to leave a good deal of space. Julian wanted me last week to get to the practical implications, which we're supposed to get to, and I will get to that, though he made me steal a bit of my own thunder in the process of doing so. But let me recapitulate. The idea of these lectures, I take it, is to demonstrate kinds of reasoning in practice and then show that they can come to useful conclusions at the end. Now, the kinds of reasoning we've been doing. In the first lecture, I was talking about Mill and the fact and the way he argued ad hominem, in the old-fashioned sense, against his opponents by showing simply that their arguments didn't work. And this is a very useful technique when you can do it. He didn't come in saying, here is a set of new moral principles which you don't accept. Here is some more research that I've done that you don't know about. What he said was, if you think about it, you will find to start with that you know perfectly well that the things you are claiming as fact aren't true. And secondly, that even if they were, the logic goes wrong in the argument. You can't justify laws keeping women out of men's terrain by saying that women can't do whatever it is, because if they couldn't do it, they wouldn't get past the selection processes in the first place. What women cannot do, it is quite superfluous to forbid them from doing. And he said the same about keeping women in marriage. If they really wanted this, Mill says, why have you got all the rules keeping them from doing anything else and thereby forcing them into marriage? And we went further than that. Another thing that interests me that I didn't really bring out in the first lecture, if you go right back to the fundamentals, you don't just ask about the generalities of women being legally subordinate to men, but if you look into the details of the differential requirements, moral requirements for the two sexes, you begin to see that it isn't just a matter of women being weak and men strong, weak in every stronger in every shape, as James Fitzjames Stephen said. It has nothing to do with it. It's all about sex. And one of the things that's interesting about this is quite often, if you look at the details of what somebody is recommending and can show that their argument to justify it isn't working, that often gives you the basis for generating hypotheses about, if we work on the basis of finding out what argument would work, it's a very useful way of generating hypotheses about what's really going on in the background. And in this case, I was personally quite pleased about this, actually, because it's possible to work out from the arguments, as I did in my old book, that the only thing that made any sense of all the traditional rules about women and the power of men was about men's identifying their children and controlling women for that reason. And at the same time, though I didn't know it then, evolutionary psychology was coming up with empirical evidence that that was just the kind of thing you would expect of men. Not that they sat and calculated it, but that evolution would have produced in them the kind of emotions which would make them want to keep women in this position. So this is another useful thing you can do by reasoning. You can find out what would work, generate hypotheses, and then go and test them. And then another thing we discussed is, if you find two people are discussing a subject and they disagree with each other, and they don't seem to be engaging at all in the argument, one of the things you can do is work out what in the background underlies the difference between them. And you can do this by trying to work out what presuppositions they need to make in order to reach their conclusions from their premises. And this was another thing we found in the 19th century debate. James Fitz James Stephen and Mill seemed to pass each other without engaging at all. But if you look closely enough, you can see that Stephen is presupposing that the world has a natural moral order. And if people do as they should, if women and men keep to their proper roles and don't try to push each other out, then society will go smoothly. And he said the two sexes can no more have different interests, really, than different parts of the same body. Mill, of course, didn't think anything of the sort. Mill thought that the world was not morally sorted out, and that ethics was needed to do the sorting out. Right, so that was the kind of thing I was doing just by way of methodology and bringing in some of the substance while we were at it. Now, going back again to the very beginning, when people first started trying to rethink the position of the sexes, how we should organize the social framework of sex, it was obviously an issue for what we now call feminism. It was about finding what was unjust in the treatment of women, which Mill was sorting out. And what's significant is that this has continued. We have masses of feminists still, apparently in practice, continuing the discussion of how we should organize the arrangement of sex in feminist terms. That is, there's a great deal of emphasis on the things women still haven't got that they would like to get. It's obvious in many parts of the world, and in many subsections of societies, that still the traditional problems which Mill was talking about are going on. There are huge parts of the world where still women are under completely different laws from men, and where they are, this is always to the disadvantage of women, in very much the way Mill was describing the laws in 19th century England. But feminists often keep talking about equality and saying only X percent of professors are women, only women have only X percent of men's income and so on, and want to infer from this that women are still unjustly treated, even in countries like ours and America and other Western countries. And this is a very difficult matter to grapple with, because we have got rid of the rules which distinguish between men and women, and we're doing more and more to eliminate the conventions that discriminated between them. But still we find that men and women aren't coming out equal. And this seems to be, to a lot of people, evidence of continuing discrimination. Now, according to Mill's kind of criterion, the essential injustice to women was that if you looked at the laws which divided them and made them treated separately, you simply could not give a general justification of those laws that worked in terms of the political principles which were then being accepted. What that meant was that women were subject to an arbitrary disadvantage, arbitrary in this very specific sense of their interests not being counted as equal to men's in the fundamentals of law. That is, there was no positional indifference. If you were in women's position, you were arbitrarily worse off. Now, this is essentially what we catch by the idea of discrimination. It's an arbitrary doing down of a group. But arbitrariness, of course, is relative to what you've got in the background, whether something is arbitrary or not. And it's very difficult to claim simply on the grounds of men's and women's coming out unequally that there is still discrimination of this kind of arbitrary disadvantaging going on. Because in order to do that, you'd have to, in fact, it gets more complicated the more you look at it, this, you'd have to claim that just about everything that happens to people is because of the way they're treated by other people, which is quite complex in itself. But also, you'd have to claim that essentially men and women are the same on average. And if they come out differently, that's because somebody's treating them differently and treating them unjustly differently. Now, I was talking last week about this idea put forward by 1,000 signatories to an advertisement in the New York Times that everybody, all human beings, were endowed naturally with the same intelligence, which means that if they end up differently, it's somebody's fault for having them treated differently. There's the same idea about men and women, but it's a priori. I mean, a priori, given a bit of science in the background. It would, unless you think that minds are completely free-floating from bodies, you could not possibly take it for granted that the main systematic division in the species is going to have no effect at all on the mental carryings on of those of the two sides of the species. And even if that had been a priori plausible, the sort of work that's been going on in both detailed work in the, at the present time on men and women, and also from the evolutionary psychology I was talking about, it is clear that there are large general differences between the sexes. This is only on average. It isn't saying anything, as James Fitzjames Stephen was saying, about the essence of the sexes, what they will inevitably be, how they will inevitably act. It says nothing at all about the impossibility of changing them. It just says that you would expect, because they're subjected to different evolutionary pressures, that they would tend to come out rather differently on average. So you simply cannot infer from the unequal position of men and women that they're still being unjustly treated. And yet there's obviously something in the feminist idea that even though the laws are not still distinguishing between the sexes in the way that they did, somehow there's still something carrying on, even in the most enlightened places, that has the same effect. And it's very difficult to pin down, because if you're a feminist who is expecting to get equality of situation for the sexes out of the end position, if you're that kind of feminist, every time you see there is a difference of outcome between men and women, you will postulate some subtle input which accounts for it. And even if you don't find it, you may go on saying, well, it's just so subtle that we can't see it. You may go on being suspicious of it. But it won't do for that. If we're going to find that the sum of the old injustice to women still continuing, we need to find some way of identifying it, because then we can target it and get rid of it. There are some ways we can do this experimentally. For instance, we can do things like things that have often been done, tests where you give academic articles and essays to both to students and to other academics to grade. And if you find that when you swap names on the articles so that the men's appear as women's and the women's as men's, if you find the grades change, which you still do to a large extent, you have reason to think that something is going on there, though it may not be exactly clear what. But I think we've got to do more about it than that. And this goes to a point which I was bringing up at the end of the last lecture, which is that we need to consider not just formal laws, but also entrenched moralities. The sort of thing that that Jonathan Haidt and other moral psychologists are discussing, such as he emphasizes that we seem to be a very deeply moral species in the sense that we internalize very automatically and rapidly ways that we ought and ought not to behave. It seems to be a thing that we're very good at picking up. In fact, children are always wanting to know what the rules are. And we seem to be capable of internalizing these rules that we learn in ways that mean that we frequently are willing to act against our own interests in order to go along with these rules. And not only to act against our own interests directly in refraining from doing things we would like to do, we're willing to put social effort into punishing other people who infringe those rules, even though it's at our own cost to put this effort into it. This is very much like an informal version of laws, because the point about laws is that the whole society, well, I mean, that's a rough thing, but whole society enforces them and punishes people who are aberrant. And the idea of moral standards is that they work rather like this, in that the society will put its resources into penalizing people who do the wrong thing. And you can see this happening in all our present day discussions. You can see that no matter how much it costs to keep people in prison, a lot of the public are very willing to pay that price just to make sure that people get punished. They sometimes say that it's just to keep them from doing more harm, and that's part of the issue. But it's very clear that the wish to punish aberrant people is pretty strong. Now, if that's the case, that would be the kind of context where we should look for traditional discrimination still going on. We should try to find ways in which males and females are treated differently, in the sense that they're rewarded and punished for different things and encouraged to do different things, and may even internalize these standards for themselves. For instance, it's very striking that in the 19th century, again, when Mill was trying to get the vote for women and wanted person put in the legislation instead of men, lots of the people who were against him were women. There were women writing tracts against enfranchisement of women, saying that it would essentially upset the whole order, it would mess things up, women would be deprived of doing their specific functions in society. So if we think in terms of particular kinds of moral standard that have been internalized as things that will carry on the differentiation between men and women, that would be the kind of thing we need to target. And the way to find that is not, I think, by going right back to the fundamentals and saying, can we justify this differential treatment? It's by looking at the patterns which would have carried on from the past. Because again, one of the things that moral psychologists are telling us is that once you've got a moral idea in your head, it is remarkably resistant to change. And this is why people keep fudging arguments. What happened in the case of James Fitzjames Stephen, for instance, he was obviously thoroughly convinced that men and women had these separate functions, and thoroughly convinced that the whole society had to have these functions fulfilled in order to run smoothly. And therefore he, as it were, invented the nature of women to fit the theory. So if we look at the kinds of ideas about women which have been an essential part of that theory, we should be able to see which elements to target. Now, I'm not sure about those, these in general, but the obvious one, one of the obvious ones anyway, is the idea that women simply can't do things that men can do. Because if we've got them, if it's been impossible for them to do them in the past or difficult for them to do them, and we simply haven't had the chance to see them doing them because people have been presuming that women can't do them in a self-perpetuating way, then it's a kind of thing we need to look out for, and it might be a kind of context in which we need to do some kind of affirmative action just so that women have a chance to do these things, and then people will be able to see that they can do them and get rid of the prejudice. It's very hard to get rid of the prejudice. I heard of a child who was playing doctors and nurses and said that the men had to be doctors and the women nurses, and her own mother was a doctor. But it still seems to persist to some extent. But that's one kind of thing we can look out for absence of opportunity. And also look at ideas about women that make them in general fit that traditional position. Now, I'm going to come back to this later when I talk about the difference between the sexes and evolutionary psychology again. But there's an interesting thing about this. If you say that what is wrong with the treatment of the sexes traditionally, and that it counts as discrimination in the sense of an arbitrary doing down of a group, people often want to say, if you want to let women into something more easily than men, this is reverse discrimination and just as bad as discrimination the other way around. But it depends entirely on the justification you give for it. Because if you say that my reason for doing this, letting women in at a lower standard perhaps, is not giving them an arbitrary benefit, that isn't the purpose. The purpose is to achieve some social end which we regard as important, achieving justice for women by getting rid of the old discrimination. You can actually defend this by saying it isn't an arbitrary benefit to women, it's just a means to a particular end. You're not doing it for the women, you're doing it for the purpose to be achieved. And then you'd have to go into empirical arguments about whether it would be likely to achieve that end. And that is exactly where you get all the questions about if you lower the standards too far, then you just entrench people's ideas. But it does mean that all the arguments about reverse discrimination and affirmative action and such can't be dealt with in the very quick way that they normally are. So we need, if we're going to see which aspects of the position, current position of women and men can still be attributed to the hangover from the old treatment, and which may be to do with the real differences between women and men, we need to do, I think, a double approach. We need to see which characteristics would have been expected in the past and look suspiciously at those, and at the same time consider directly which characteristics we have modern scientific evidence for, and not try to say that there's something wrong with those. There's not the slightest reason to expect men and women to do the same things on average, even without discrimination. But we still need to get at the discrimination and try to get rid of it. So I think the answer to well, it isn't an answer, it's a beginning of a methodological approach to how to get rid of what's residual, is to look not just at the principle that was wrong, which was the unequal consideration of men and women in the foundation of the laws, but to look at the particular form it took. And this is interesting because it's one of the ways in which we can see that people's detailed moral views, the particular things they expect, are things that can carry on through massive moral change. One of the remarkable things about the position of women is that it persisted through major revolutions. it persisted through the taking over of the world by Christianity in the Roman time. The Bible clearly says in God there is neither male nor female, but still there's the expectation that that women should be subordinate. It carried on. It carried on through the American Revolution, through the Enlightenment, through the Chinese Revolution, through the Russian Revolution. You get people radically changing their political views, but they're so convinced about the treatment of the sexes that it manages to persist. And then they start rationalizing in terms of the new theory. And this rationalization is where things keep going wrong in the argument, and it's one of the places where practical philosophy can come in and show what's happening. It's very common indeed. Anyone in our department will know, for instance, that it's extremely common in medical ethics. People who really have a religious objection to something or other will, these days, automatically try to justify it in terms of non-religious arguments. And this is one of the commonest places where reasoning in practical ethics goes wrong. So I do think there's some feminist stuff left to do. I think it's extremely hard to pin it down, and I don't think we should presume that any inequalities of outcome are to do with discrimination. We need to identify it directly. Now, the other thing I brought out from Mill in the first lecture was that Mill, in effect, he didn't make much of it, but it was very clear from what he was doing and the way he argued that he was seeing the question of the subjection of women as entirely independent of more general questions about how society should be run. While Mill was arguing for getting women treated the same way as men, he was also in the thick of all the political arguments about who should get the vote and education and things like that, which had nothing to do with women in particular. They were perfectly general. And there were lots of arguments going on at the time about who should vote, who should be educated, who should get various privileges. This was completely separate, as you can see from the fact that Mill said in the context of the vote, under whatever conditions men are admitted to the franchise, there is not a shadow of a reason for not admitting women on the same criteria. So he was regarding them as being two completely different issues. One, what general rules should we have organizing society? And the other, stop treating women differently and rewarding them and punishing them for different things. And I think this is one of the things that has to be remembered when we're considering what kind of framework we should have for organizing the treatment of the sexes, because it's not the same as the disadvantaging of women. Even if women had never been disadvantaged, even if there had been the kind of equality that I think Mill was aiming for, there would still have been all sorts of other questions which Mill didn't raise, like whether marriage should be permanent, whether you should be able to get divorces, who should own the children if you did separate, whether society should force you to stay together. All these questions are nothing directly to do with justice for women. They're just questions about how to organize society from the point of view of sex. Now, the other thing I was talking about in the first lecture was the way technology has absolutely transformed our lives from this point of view, because it was obvious before technology got very far, that the differential role of men and women was nothing to do with being enforced by law. It was a simple fact of biology. Babies cannot get on without having breastfeeding mothers, so obviously there's going to be a difference of sex role. And there is in nearly all sexed species. How close the two get depends on whether both sexes are needed for bringing up the children. And it looks as though in our species, they were both needed, because we have this general pair bonding way of doing things. So it looks as though fathers were necessary from early on. That doesn't follow that fathers should have owned the females and the children, as the law eventually allowed them to do. But we've still got the question of how we're going to organise sex. Now, I think given contraception, given DNA paternity testing, given the radical changes in the business of just running your day-to-day life, labour-saving devices in the home and so on, and given the change in work outside the home, which is far less dependent on upper body strength than a good deal of traditional work was, it seems to me that this is an open question, but I can't see any reason why the law should actually specify sex as a distinguishing thing at any point. Maybe it should, but the sort of things that the law is concerned with, which, you know, things like protecting children, who's going to live with whom and so on, it seems quite unnecessary now to do it on the basis of sex. You can do it in general terms. If you are looking after children, this is what we require of you. If you go through a certain kind of ceremony and have a certain kind of undertaking, this is what we require of you. And it's hard to see why sex should come into it at all. If we want to say both people should have to support any child that they're responsible for begetting, we can do it through DNA testing and so on. Now, this is obviously highly technologically dependent, and there are vast parts of the world where this isn't true and where it may still be necessary to talk about the sexes as such. But from our point of view, it seems unnecessary to mention sex as such at all. Now, if we go into, I'm going back to feminism again, what are we going to say about what women should demand about the general arrangements for the sexes? Because there are a great many pressures, again from feminists, which have varied a lot over the time when feminism has been going recently. For instance, wages for housework, lots of childcare, forcing men to do just as much housework as women. There have been masses and masses of different suggestions about what's required for justice. Now, if you're talking about the general laws rather than about discrimination, which treats the sexes differently, one thing is clear: before you can say things are unjust to either sex, you need a theory of justice. Now, this is logically important, and I think it's a thing that often gets overlooked in feminism, because feminists, certainly feminist academics, often go far beyond the idea of differential treatment and say that we ought to have feminist approaches to just about everything, that we ought to have feminist political theory, feminist ethics, even feminist epistemology and philosophy of science, those things. Now, it's never very clear what is meant by feminist in this context, because obviously one of the things that goes on under these headings is still finding discrimination in these contexts. For instance, a lot of feminists are concerned about the way some political theories, they criticize Rawls, for instance, will presume still that there are going to be heads of households and things. I'm totally out of date with this, so I don't know what feminists are now saying. But there's a matter of logic, as far as I can see. There's no reason for saying there should be feminist ways of doing things, because if you're saying that it's for instance, I was doing some work on feminist epistemology once, and they were saying, when you assess an epistemological theory, you've got to consider who benefits from it, whose interests it's in. Now, you can't do it that way round, because until you've got your epistemological theory, you can't even get your description of what state people are in and who is benefiting from it. And it also presupposes a theory that that you need justice in order to work. Well, you can see what I mean, and I'm not going to do it in detail because I'm running out of time. But I think my view is that these issues about how we should organize sex in general cannot be feminist issues. They must be just general political issues. So what do we find out about them? Well, we have quite a lot of problems which we need to sort out, which are specifically about the sexes, even though I think that we are not going to be making any laws and institutions which are dependent on sex as such. And you notice, by the way, that I say sex rather than gender. I should have commented on this before. I'm still sticking to this. I know I've lost the battle, but I'm still sticking to it because gender was brought in by feminists as a way, as a different thing from sex. It was supposed to be about the socially induced characteristics of the sexes. And the slip into calling sex gender is all part of the idea that everything is socially induced and that the sexes are only different because of the pressures that have been put on them. So I still stick to sex when I mean sex and leave entirely open the question of how much is socially induced. Now, if we're going to start working out how to manage society between the sexes, and we're not going to make laws differentiate between them, the question is whether we need to know anything at all about the differences between them and which kinds of problems we need to solve. And I said before, rather facetiously, but I was taken seriously, that patriarchy did in fact solve a great many problems, because if women and children are in the power of men, it gives you a lot less to sort out. You just have to sort out the men when you're thinking up your political theory. But as soon as you give everybody equal rights, you have an enormously more complex situation to deal with. So, in particular, we have the obvious question of how to bring up children. Are we going to put individuals under any pressures at all about how to deal with children? Are we going to make laws about children, or are we just going to have a kind of free-for-all? Now, this is where I want to get back to the kind of world that James Fitzjames Stephen was thinking of, because he was presupposing a particular kind of order such that if you stayed in your proper place, if you obeyed the rules of the time, things would be all right because men and women couldn't really have different interests. Evolution, as I shall come to in a moment, says that men and women have radically different interests. We'll come to that later. But now in the matter of children, how much are we supposed to... It was clear that men owned the children. It was clear that ownership of children was a significant issue. That is, parents, or fathers at least, wanted the power over their children, bringing them up, saying what they could do, bringing them up in particular religions, for instance. We don't like talking about children like that now. We don't like talking about parents having rights over children as property. But there is obviously an element of that in everybody's thinking about their own children. Nobody wants the state to take over and make decisions about their children. And there's tremendous competition when the good of the children turns up. The law fudges this completely. The Children Act, when it was passed, said that parental rights derived from children's rights I defy them to make any clear sense of that. Because the whole point is that if the parent has a right, that is as opposed to other people's rights. It's just a way of saying, well, the only thing we're concerned with is the good of the children, and that's all that parental rights are doing. And yet we know that there are lots of rotten parents. We simply have not sorted out how much we want to be concerned about the good of the children and how much we want to give people rights, not only to reproduce, but to control the children after they're born. This is a huge problem. And do we want to say anything about the way, about who can have children? We have for some time, and this is why I've got in a muddle, but this is why I was talking about James Fitzjames Stephen. People now are committed largely, the bien pensant, are committed to a principle of reproductive freedom. Everybody should be free to have children under any circumstances they want. We should be free to have single parents. We should be free to have any number of people bringing up children. The idea is that we shouldn't say who has children. We shouldn't say under what circumstances they have children. And there is also a tendency to resist any empirical evidence that implies that this is going to have bad outcomes. It is really dangerous these days to suggest that it might be bad for children on the whole if they only have one parent. It's pretty well unacceptable to suggest that children might not do better, might not do equally well, if they have an absent parent who's out at work all day. Now, I have no knowledge at all about this, but it is striking that it has become unacceptable to say it. And if we are going to take seriously that the world is not a place with a basic moral order, but on which we have to impose some kind of moral structure, that means we should not be absolutely convinced of the principles that we're going to enforce directly. That is, don't interfere with people's wishes to have children. Don't interfere with the arrangements they make for their family lives. And then you're going to be convinced that that's going to turn out right. You're going to have to fudge the empirical bit in the middle in just the same way as James Fitzjames Stephen did when he presumed that the real nature of women was to fit into an ordered world. But we have got to a stage, and this is where I said I was going to bring up political correctness. If we're going to change the moral standards of the world, we're going to have to put people under pressures to accept different moral principles. But what political correctness tends to do in practice is also say that there are many empirical claims you must not make, because if you make them, you are taken to be on the wrong side of the argument. If you were to have the temerity to claim empirically that women don't seem to have the very high mathematical ability that some men do, not many men, but some men do. If you make a claim like that, you're accused of being sexist, as if this were the same kind of thing as you're saying women should be kept in their place irrespective of what their abilities are. So it seems to me a really important step to make to say if we take on ideologies in the sense that we're absolutely committed to something like reproductive freedom, the danger is that we will presume that this is also going to have a good outcome, as James Fitzjames Stephen did, and resist the kind of empirical work we need in between. Because people tend to presume that if you say women at the extremes aren't as good at maths as men, or children may suffer from having only a single parent, or the parent going out to work, they tend to presume that you're therefore arguing that this ought to happen, that this ought not to happen, that this means mothers should stay at home, that this means girls shouldn't do high-level maths or something like that. It doesn't mean anything of the sort. And one of the things we have to get clear in our practical philosophy arguments is that you can raise an empirical question, in fact, you must raise empirical questions, without being taken to give them the answer to the moral problem. It's only one element of the moral problem, and it's one of the main mistakes people make in reasoning in politics. If you say certain things, you're presumed to have reached certain practical conclusions. We want to be able to break the thing up and show how the arguments work. And this can be done, but it's very hard work in public, and especially when people are doing sound bites. So we have real questions about children. And if we care about the well-being of children, we not only have the moral problem of balancing children and parents, and furthermore, fathers and mothers if they separate, and questions about whether we are going to force people to stay together longer than they want to stay together, or look disapproving if they separate before the children are grown up. Those are all questions which we have to confront and not just avoid because we say reproductive freedom. When the Prime Minister was talking about giving tax incentives to marriage recently, there was an outcry that the state should not be intervening in private life in this way and manipulating people. Why shouldn't it? If it turned out that making marriage rather more permanent, divorce more difficult, was better for children, that's a thing we need to know if we want to make the world better. Now, in the final few minutes, there are various other ways in which we need to think about the empirical stuff if we're going to reach conclusions about how to manage society. And this is where the evolutionary psychology comes. And evolutionary psychology is caricatured by its opponents. And its opponents are invariably people who are afraid of its political implications, which incidentally it hasn't got directly because it depends on what values you bring in. It's caricatured as things like just so stories. You think of an evolutionary explanation for something and you believe that this is therefore proved. This is nonsense. Evolutionary psychology is just asking questions from a different direction. It looks as though this would have been advantageous to males and females during their evolutionary history. Shall we do some tests and find out whether this is still going on now? And this is an active bit of research, which is by no means complete. But it looks extremely unlikely that men and women can have the same emotions. There's nothing in evolutionary psychology, I should emphasize, to suggest that women would have lesser abilities of an intellectual kind than men. There is nothing whatever in evolutionary psychology to suggest that women are as James Fitzjames Stephen said they were. And this is a thing that needs to be borne in mind by feminists who are afraid that if we concede there are differences between the sexes, we're playing into the hands of the conservative opposition. Because what evolutionary psychology is saying has nothing to do with what the conservative opposition were saying, people like James Fitzjames Stephen, that women were incapable of various things. But if they are different, it looks as though we really ought to understand these differences, partly for large-scale social planning, particularly the demographics, because it really is quite worrying. I'm sorry our sponsors and visitors are not here from Japan, because here is an illustration. Evolutionary psychology would suggest, and there's quite a bit of evidence, that women look for men who are able to support their offspring, that the women tend to go for a higher status man to improve their own position. Now, it's an interesting question because feminists were saying early on in feminism that once women were properly independent, they wouldn't need to depend on men and they'd be quite happy to marry the dustman. So, now, this has not seemed to happen. What has seemed to happen is that as women have got higher and higher status, they're looking for men of higher status still, and it goes without saying that there are not enough of them to go round. We have no reason to think that men are better at all these things. And we are beginning to find that kind of thing. One documentary from Japan and one newspaper article. Newspaper article from Japan that ugly men, I don't know whether they meant low status, but they said ugly, I think, were not being able to get married anymore because the women didn't want them. Now the women were independent. They didn't need these low-grade men anymore. And so what they were doing was refusing to get married, leaving all these men stranded. And we have plenty of trouble with men being left stranded anyway with the demographics of India and China and all the female infanticide and abortion. We've got the great problem that men are not attached as much as they used to. Women are less inclined to take on just any old man. Whereas during the traditional subordination of women, where women had no choice effectively but to get married, and you have monogamy, it meant that women had to attach themselves to some man or other, pretty well irrespective of whether they wanted to. And this comes at, once you start thinking about it in this sort of way, all kinds of things fall into place. For instance, I'm sure most of us know, just as we know lots of philandering men, we know lots of men who've been married for ages and are miserable because their wives won't have sex with them. Now, if the women married them because they needed economic support, it meant that a lot of women were marrying men that they didn't find attractive enough and didn't want sex with. It's one of these things that starts falling into place when you realize how the interest of the sexes works. And the other thing we know, again, that was one part of the demographics of Japan. The other part was a BBC documentary, which was fascinating, showing that they now have these host clubs, which were the equivalent of the geisha establishments of the past. And these are run by men for women. And the women who frequent them are well-paid businesswomen who will go into these places and spend a fortune on drinks, which they then share with the men. And you never know with documentaries because they're so selective, but the men seemed to be leading the women on, implying that they were just taking the relationship slowly, but allowing the women to think that real relationships were developing through this. It rather implies that these Japanese women want these relationships, that men are exploiting it, but they just can't find enough men that they really want. And we have all kinds of evidence, as I was saying last week, that unattached men, unmated men are a real nuisance. You just have to look at inner city America. I gather the same thing is happening on housing estates here where the women don't want the men and the men are pretty useless. And if men haven't got any real investment in children, it's the flip side of the welfare state. We want to make sure that if women do have children on their own, they're not ostracized, they're supported by the state. But if the men can't improve the women's position by joining in with them, we've got all these men on the loose. Now, I don't know what to say about this, because I don't want women to have to be take up with men they don't want. But it's a serious question. And then the other thing I will just mention, because this is just the kind of thing we should be discussing in the general discussion, there is the fact that, as far as we can tell from evolutionary psychology, according to Robert Wright, who wrote a rather good early book on this subject, the sexes seem designed by evolution to make each other miserable. I mean, we know about this sort of thing. Most people will know that after sex, the response of men and women is rather different. The men switch off their desires and are wanting to be up and off, and the women are not. And again, there are quite good, plausible evolutionary explanations for this. If you're going to conceive, you need to stay still to allow conception to happen, while the male probably ought to be up and trying to seduce other women to get more offspring. What one does with things like that, I don't know. And there are even more terrifying things, which just about everybody will recognize. Again, suggested by Robert Wright. If evolution is, the sexes are completely opposed in a lot of ways. As a lot of the evolutionary theorists say, once you've got sex developing in evolution, each sex is going to try to leave the other one holding the baby, because that's the best way to get as many genes as possible going on. So females and males in our species have been rivals in this sense, in the ultimate genetic sense, from very early on, and the men won that one. They left the women holding the baby. This, of course, doesn't mean that at the phenotypic level we're at odds, but it also looks as though we're at odds to a large extent at that level, and we have to keep cheating each other. There's an evolutionary arms race where each sex is trying to get the edge on the other. And it leads to things like, just think of a man who is really in love and courting a woman. How does he act? He acts in exactly the way that women want men to act. He appears absolutely devoted to her. He swears and he really believes that he's going to go on feeling like that for the rest of his life. Now, what Wright says is that this is just what you'd expect evolution to do, because the best way to deceive somebody is really to have the feelings which deceive them. So it looks as though, if we take this kind of line, evolution may have designed men to be just what women want, but then it doesn't design the men to go on being like that. And it leaves the women wondering what on earth has happened, and everybody blaming everybody. Anyway, these are questions which don't sound so much like issues for political theory, but I have a suspicion that there might be all kinds of conventions of courtesy we might call on for these issues, and possibly demand... No, this is going too far. I went too far last week by, by going off into fantasy. I will leave it there.